Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The deadly conflict between Israel and Hamas, as well as its own Arab minority, have been devastating, claiming nearly 300 lives in Gaza, while a dozen Israelis have been killed in Hamas rocket strikes. What's different about this conflict is that Israel's Arab minority, that constitutes 20% of the population, has been engaged in unprecedented protests that Israel's President Reuven Rivlin has called the potential for civil war. The trigger was a decision by the Netanyahu government to authorize additional Jewish housing units in East Jerusalem, complicating efforts to create a future Arab capital for a future Palestinian state. Israeli strikes have faced international criticism, including from prominent Democrats in the United States, who have lambasted President Biden for giving Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cover to extend his campaign against Hamas. Biden yesterday, in unusually blunt terms, called on Israel to embrace a ceasefire, a call that Netanyahu, for the time being, has brushed aside. Joining us now to discuss the conflict, why it's different, and what's next are Dr. John Alterman, the Zbigniew Brzezinski Chair for Global Security and Geostrategy, as well as the Director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council. John, thanks very much for joining us. It's been entirely too long. And Ilan, always great to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me, Vargo.
Oh, great to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage on this, the 10th anniversary of the Iron Dome system, which has been in the headlines, and we may or may not discuss it. John, this conflict in many respects, right, it's a dog bites man story, right? Israel and Hamas at odds, Israel striking tunnel complex, Hamas barraging Israel with a mix of precision and very, very imprecise weapons. No incursion yet, although under the ground, there looks like that might be the case, where Israeli combat engineers have always played a leading role in one of the most dangerous missions in the world. Israel has always tried to be very careful in how it manages the perception of how it's seen in these conflicts, although that seems to have been changing during the Netanyahu government. Talk to us a little bit about why this conflict is different, what it means, and what it portends for the future, especially if it looks like Israel is coming under some criticism, including from some of the nation's leading Jewish American politicians, for example, Bernie Sanders, who's trying to interrupt $735 million in military aid to Israel.
Thanks, Vargo. I think several things are going on. One is that Benjamin Netanyahu changed Israel's relations with the world. He's forged important relationships with China and Russia. He's forged a very important relationship with India. He forged relationships really unthinkable until the summer with the UAE and Bahrain, and deepen the relationship with Morocco, and you have a new relationship with Sudan, and others are contemplating them. But I think you have to start from thinking about the proposition of, is Netanyahu really isolated? And I think there's a sense in the United States, a lot of people have, especially among Democrats, that he's isolated. I think among Israelis, you look and you say, well, China's a billion plus, and India's a billion plus, and Russia's a superpower, and we have a increasingly close relationship with Russia. I think Netanyahu is in many ways written off much of Western Europe. Eastern Europe seems very comfortable with him. And during the Trump administration, you have very close relations with the United States. So I think in many ways, from Netanyahu's perspective and from the perspective of many Israelis who support Netanyahu, Israel is far more accepted in the world now than it ever has been before. It's due to Benjamin Netanyahu. And if some people are queasy about what it takes to maintain Israel's security and independence in the Middle East, well, that's their problem. It's not Israel's problem. That's, I think, a view I've heard increasingly expressed in Israel. There is something else going on as well, which I think is very important from an American perspective, is in the process of Benjamin Netanyahu building closer relationships with Republicans and especially with evangelical Christians, an idea that seemed strange and far-fetched when he started doing in the 1990s and has become a core right. of Israel support in the United States. He's also alienated increasing numbers of Democrats and especially young and progressive Democrats. And as somebody who is related to many young progressive Democrats, I can tell you their relationship to Israel is very different from their parents' relationship to Israel. I think there is a school of thought in Israel that says this is very important and consequential and has to be stopped. And there's a school of thought in Israel that says, we don't care. And I was at a very uncomfortable dinner party in Israel when a former Israeli ambassador to the United States wanted me to put forward this argument. And other former Israeli ambassadors and former Israeli national security officials scoffed at it and said, there's no problem with the U.S.-Israel relationship. There's no problem with young members of the American Jewish community. It's just your fuzzy-headed leftist friends, but the relationship is strong. Look at how many people come to AIPAC conferences and everything else. I think it is changing. I think the core of American support for Israel is changing. The nature of it's changing. And certainly the Democratic Party is changing. And Israel has gone from being a bipartisan issue for decades in the United States, not always, but for decades, to becoming an increasingly partisan issue. I think Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't think that's problematic. Other Israelis do.
I would also add, right, I mean, Israel has moved very strategically, not just with the UAE and Bahrain, but obviously with Saudi Arabia as well. I mean, there was a senior Israeli leader who I once joked with, you know, I said, don't you qualify for your Saudi citizenship yet, given how much time he was also spending in Riyadh in order to create that strategic alliance against Iran. Conversely, one of the problems there, at least from a Palestinian perspective, is that Palestinian and Israeli Arabs don't feel like they're getting support from anywhere in the Middle East, in part because of that strategic consideration, right? Folks in the Gulf are much more interested in what's happening in Tehran than they are about what's happening in the West Bank. Ilan, let me bring you into the conversation. How do you see this dynamic? How do you see it emerging and evolving?
Sure. Well, thanks, Vago. And let me start at the outset. I tend to agree with John. I think there's some profound shifts that are happening in terms of political identity and in terms of political identification among the American Jewish community. And that's playing out in terms of support for Israel, support that used to be pretty unassailable, ironclad, and bipartisan, and increasingly is beginning to divide along partisan lines and divide along generational lines. And, you know, that's certainly something to watch. I think a couple of other things to watch here are that, you know, undoubtedly, sort of what John said was correct, which is that over the last 4 years, there was, you know, the administration in power had a very philo-Semitic view, had a very laissez-faire attitude to Israeli policies. And it helped that sort of that hands-off attitude did help to provide momentum to things that Prime Minister Netanyahu had started to put into play, which is this sort of this quiet conversation with at the Arab Gulf states. And, you know, we had talked in the past about the fact that that conversation, when it started some 12 years ago or so, was really tactical, right? It was all in concern about Iran and the sort of the threat posed by Iran and the need for a regional response to it. But Bibi's peculiar genius, if you could call it that, is that he's managed to parlay those tactical conversations into this strategic realignment where Israel is talking directly to the Gulf Arab states and the Palestinian issue, which used to be central to Israeli politics, has sort of receded from view. But, you know, there's a dark side to that part of the conversation as well, which is that Israel over the years has become convinced that the Palestinian issue, it can get away with simply managing the Palestinian issue rather than solving it. And that's been reinforced by this dialogue that it's had with the Arab world, certainly a dialogue that's been turbocharged over the last couple of years. But as we see from the sort of the scenes playing out over the last couple of weeks, it's a little bit of a trickier thing to manage this situation than the Israeli officials have been saying. There's a lot of interconnectedness, as we see, between external threats from the Gaza Strip to the state of Israel, and also the internal disposition and political enfranchisement of Israel's Arab minority. And so those things are beginning to sort of to connect, and you know, Hamas in timing its response, in its public messaging, in terms of what it's been doing over the last couple of weeks, has taken a lot of pains to try to connect those two things, things that the Israelis, first of all, thought were frankly disconnected for a long time, and also thought that they had well in hand. And you know, the answer to both of those things, it looks like, is that's not the case.
Can I just add one thing to what Ilan said, which I agree with, and that is, you know, there's a way in which the issue of Palestine, the issue of Arab rights, is a very divisive issue in Israel, and it gets to a whole set of questions about what is it to be a Jewish state, and who's a citizen, and what are the rights of citizens, and all kinds of things. The unifying issue in Israel is Iran. Right. Everybody in Israel believes that Iran is an existential threat. And I think Netanyahu has politically tried to drive the conversation to be, we're having an Iran conversation, the security threat is Iran. We systematically don't have a problem, an Arab problem that we have to solve either domestically or externally. And we can just, as Ilan was saying, we can just ignore it and it will go away. And what I think we saw this past month is you have a Jerusalem dispute, and then Hamas from Gaza projects itself in, makes decisions about when there will be a war and what the terms of that war will be, and suddenly Israel is not in control. After Israel was convinced, partly encouraged by the Trump administration, Israel was convinced that they really didn't have a problem. And what they have is they have not only a Hamas problem, but they have a broader Palestinian problem. They have an Israeli Arab problem, which needs addressing.
One of the fundamental problems here is that it is a cycle of opportunism and counter opportunism, right? I mean, Hamas was very, very unpopular before this started. They were unpopular when the rockets first started getting fired because everybody in Gaza knew how this is going to play.
Careful. I mean, some of the polling was that Hamas would have done reasonably well in the legislative and presidential elections coming up. I think they were not, they certainly were polling a lot stronger than Mahmoud Abbas was polling.
No, but correct. But what I'm saying is, right, Abbas is not very popular. Hamas, unfortunately, right, I mean, having actually been in Gaza City, having this conversation on, you know, with both Israelis as well as with Palestinians, right, Hamas was created in part with help from Israel in order to be a counterweight against Fatah, right? I mean, so each one of these things has, you know, a political penalty that goes with it. Ultimately, the question, you know, and Netanyahu looked like he was likely going to lose the premiership. Now that's not the case because Israelis have rallied around the flag, as is the case. What does this dynamic look like going forward? Because nobody has been, you know, and certainly, and Ilan, I'm going to push back a little bit. I think people in Israel, when this dialogue began with the Gulf nations, were trying to do something more deeply strategic and not purely tactical. The cover was a tactical thing. What they wanted was a strategic shift, as people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem would tell me, you know, that we want to make the conditions so that the Palestinians don't really matter. So we've actually kind of achieved that over the last X number of years. The question is, at what point do they matter or do they not matter, right? Netanyahu is distinctly not interested in a two-state solution and doing everything he possibly can to forestall that. The precipitous withdrawal from Gaza was to say, ooh, look what happens if we withdraw, right? So we can't withdraw. That was brilliant by the Sharon government. So what does this look like going forward? Or is this sort of simmering, every once in a while we'll have an eruption and nobody's really going to address it? And frankly, does it really matter if they don't? I don't mean to sound unkind by that. Where does this go?
So
especially if Israeli Arabs now are involved in this in a passionate way. And again, as Ilan mentioned, right, there's also a generational bipartisan rift, right? With a newer generation of Jewish Americans who are actually not particularly happy about this, whether their parents are Democrats or Republicans. Go ahead, Ilan, if you want to take it away.
No. Let me just jump in for a second. I'm sort of curious to see how John responds to the question too. The thing about the inside game is, I think, supremely important. It's not really very much covered in the press. The opportunism, the strategic opportunism of Hamas in this conflict, I think really needs to be recognized and appreciated, because the unrest comes against the backdrop of Palestinian elections, where, you know, John's absolutely right. You know, the polling suggests that Hamas was looking sort of very strong and looking like it could very much outpoll and sort of outperform Mahmoud Abbas in terms of Palestinian representation. And frankly, that's the reason why Palestinian elections were eventually canceled. But what Hamas has managed to do, because, you know, Hamas was obviously looking forward to a dominant political position, and, you know, that had been sort of stripped from it, that sort of that opportunity had flittered away. And so Hamas, in terms of both its rhetoric, in terms of how it's been conducting itself, in terms of the strategic timing, this is very much for them. This is very much an inside game. They are using their external campaign of aggression against Israel as an internal political dialogue with other Palestinians, saying, look, Abbas is no longer your champion. We are here. We're the ones who are willing to mobilize. We're the ones who are willing to sort of to take it to the Israelis, to champion your rights, to safeguard your rights. It is, in terms of strategic messaging, this is a hugely important development on the part of Hamas, which has, you know, traditionally been comparatively tone deaf in terms of sort of talking about political currents in the broader Middle East. And it creates another problem that the Israelis are going to need to solve, or, you know, one that's frankly much more intractable and is going to be much more difficult to solve than simply with rockets and bombs. It's that, you know, Hamas is trying to capture this Palestinian narrative and to animate the Palestinian narrative in a way that promotes itself and raises its stature. And that's something Israel is going to have to deal with as well.
And to pull back even more, I think it's really important to see there are three simultaneous political crises going on. There's a struggle within Hamas between Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Deif to determine the future of Hamas. Yahya Sinwar was somebody who would always cut deals with the Israelis, and Mohammed Deif was somebody who argued you had to be tough with the Israelis, you had to strike the Israelis. You have this battle that Ilan has just talked about with Mahmoud Abbas, long past his expiration date, and others challenging him for leadership of the Palestinian Authority. And then, Vago, as you pointed out, you have Benjamin Netanyahu, inconclusive in four consecutive elections, just failed to put together a government after the fourth election and was looking potentially at the end of his political career. You have these three simultaneous crises. And I think from an American diplomacy perspective, there's a question of how much can you accomplish when you have these three simultaneous crises? How much can these leaders lead anybody when these three crises are going on? And the other piece, which is the more constructive and creative piece, is can you plant seeds in trying to get out of this crisis that lead to resolving these three simultaneous crises in constructive ways that lead you to a better future going forward? And to me, that's the real challenge for U.S. diplomacy, is not merely how do you get the bombs to stop, but is there any way to plant seeds that you can resolve these crises and hopefully get into a position where you don't go through another few years and then the Israelis use this metaphor that I hate of mowing the grass. Another few years, you just kill a few hundred people in Gaza and destroy some infrastructure. And then after a few years, you start over again.
John, you started off by framing, I think, exactly how, you know, Netanyahu's strategy and how successful that's been. But you know, Israeli friends lament a little bit. Oh, wow. You know, we're really close friends with Chinese, Russians, you know, sort of autocratic nations in the world. And we seem not to be particularly interested in getting the accolades from democracies. The United States has been long the most ardent champion and supporter of Israel. But how much schlitz does any American president have over any Israeli leader over the past several decades, much less Netanyahu? Right. I mean, if you're the American Israeli prime minister, you go to the White House and then you lecture the president who's trying to restart peace negotiations, humiliatingly so. And then your supporters vote in favor of the Israeli prime minister in Congress over the American president. You know, as friends of mine observed at that time, well, that teaches you guys a lesson, right? So how does the political dynamic work going forward, where an American president who bought time for Netanyahu, he did, right? Biden did get lambasted by his own party, who then calls for a ceasefire and that gets completely brushed aside by Netanyahu, and in fact, sharply criticized for having done so. There's a sense by some, you know, in this administration, it's a little bit ungrateful, isn't it? It's not really about grateful, but I mean, does Washington have any real leverage? Because as you said, it's a very, very important political, financial contribution community that nobody wants to offend at the end of the day, right?
Let me say three things about that. First, I think Washington and the American president in particular has tremendous strategic leverage, but not necessarily tactical leverage. It would be tremendously humiliating for an Israeli prime minister to look like he was a lapdog of the U.S. president. Mm-hmm. And I think Benjamin Netanyahu's political image is that he's nobody's lapdog. But I think strategically, Israel wants to be very cautious about alienating the United States because that has real consequences. Second, I make an observation that Israelis have fallen in love with American presidents who are empathetic and have tended to deeply dislike American presidents who are cerebral. And so they really didn't like Carter and Bush 41 and Obama. And they really liked not only Trump and Bush 43 and Reagan and Clinton. If you have to put Biden on that scale, I think Biden becomes one of the American presidents who is emotive. And I think Biden has an ability to reach out to the Israeli public and gain support in the Israeli public in a way that Obama couldn't, partly because of his long record of support for Israel and partly just because the nature of his being is something that Israelis really like in American politicians. That, I think, leads to the third thing, which is Clinton was more popular in Israel than any prime minister you have to work with. I think Biden has an ability, I wouldn't say to engage in Israeli politics, but to certainly have an influence in Israeli politics that could help determine the future of Benjamin Netanyahu. And if I were Benjamin Netanyahu or his advisor, I would be very cautious about burning that bridge, because I think that could cause tremendous political damage to Netanyahu. I think the game to play amidst all of this for Biden is to invest in trust among the Israeli public, and that will help get the Israeli leadership to do what the United States needs Israel to do, and more importantly, to not do what the U.S. needs the Israeli leadership not to do.
So I would agree, I think, in part. But listen, I think there's an elephant in the room here. And Vago, you alluded to it in passing, sort of in discussing what Netanyahu has tried to do regionally. And that elephant in the room is Iran. What you have is, you have a U.S. president that is sort of more on the emotive scale, and he has a long and proven track record in terms of proximity to Israel. But you also have his administration, which in the eyes of the Israeli decision-making elite is heading back towards a very unfavorable strategic deal with the Iranian regime. And it's creating daylight between Jerusalem and Washington in a way that frankly creates a lot of friction in bilateral relations, but also, you know, has the tendency to, at least in some Israeli quarters, to have them think that maybe this administration doesn't have Israel's best security interests in mind. And I think it's a mistake to sort of to underestimate how much this plays in the Israeli strategic imagination, because Iran does loom so large on their stage. And that's where I think the sort of the Arab part of the conversation comes in. So if we were seeing that, at least so far, the Biden administration hasn't had that much success in restraining and constraining how Israel continues its campaign, all that what you have to recognize is that Israel actually has a new set of voices that it has to listen to now that it didn't have to before. Because as Israel works to strengthen the Abraham Accords and sort of, you know, strengthen the normalization agreements that have been hammered out over the last 12 months, it is enormously attuned to the rumblings on the Arab street in places like Rabat and in Riyadh and in Dubai. And so what these regional leaders say now actually makes more difference than it did before, because Israel wants to build on the successes of the normalization deals of the last several months. And so it's going to be, it may not be quite as responsive to American entreaties, but I would argue it's probably more responsive than ever before to Arab entreaties.
In a very close domestic political environment, given the importance of the Jewish American community that is supportive of Israel. And in fact, you know, as you said, John, right, a brilliant strategic move by Netanyahu and Israeli leadership to sort of get close to that evangelical community to try to get that support. Is there any dynamic, right? I mean, you said that American support is consequential. How? Right? I mean, and what if, well, you know what I mean? I mean, and how does that support potentially change or not, right? Is it rhetorical noise at the end of the day? Is it needle moving at the end of the day? How to interpret that shift? Because if you look at the community, and I grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, I mean, I think it was a traditionally Democratic neighborhood at that time. But I also know people who are, you know, fiercely patriotic Americans who are also pro-Israel, who are conservative Republicans, right?
Yeah, I think from an Israeli perspective, the feeling that U.S. support would be wavering is so disturbing as to be unthinkable. And I think that's part of why some of the Israeli leadership's in denial about what's happening, because I think it really is changing. But I think for all of Israel's avowed self-reliance and all of Israel's prowess vis-a-vis any of its regional competitors and everything else, I think it would be profoundly dislocating for Israel if there were to be a real change in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And I think they've not really thought through either how that might happen or what it might look like. And it may be that this conflict is giving people a taste of a new world that may be dawning.
And so you do believe that there is actually the tectonic shift that some observers fear may actually be underway?
I think the tectonic shift started when Benjamin Netanyahu made Israel a partisan issue in the United States. And I think that the initial gambit was he could get Republican support and he wouldn't undermine Democratic support. And for several decades, that seemed to be the case. I think in the Trump administration, he went all in with the Trump administration. He went all in anti-Obama. He went all in the Trump administration. And I think for increasing segments of the American Jewish community, and especially as we've all talked about, especially for younger American Jews, there's just not this this same sense of the importance of the centrality of the relationship. And you could argue that that's fine because the American Jewish community is likely to shrink over time and the evangelical Christian community is likely to grow. And so what Netanyahu has done is he's placed his bet on the winning horse. But I would argue that Israel as a conservative Republican calling card will then play a different place in American strategic thinking than Israel as a democracy that Republicans and Democrats alike think it's vital to safeguard as one of the United States' highest foreign policy priorities, which is where Israel's been for several decades.
Ilana, bring us
down. Yeah, Vago. No, I tend to agree with that. And I actually, I mean, this is sort of a larger conversation that's a little bit outside of the scope of work here, right? But there's lots of things that are contributing to this tectonic shift. And I think that's probably the proper word. And it's something that a number of American Jewish communal organizations have been raising the alarm about for a number of years. And it's not solely relating to what the Israeli government and the sitting prime minister does or doesn't do. It has lots of, as John said, it has lots of things to do with generational shifts. Frankly, it has lots of things to do with political leanings, with sort of more intemperate views of Israel that proliferate on college campuses, things like that. And so that's a little bit of a broader discussion. But in terms of how it plays out with regard to this conflict, one of the interesting things to me to sort of puzzle over is that, you know, it's an old saw by now that, you know, Israel isn't very good at Hasbara. It's not very good at strategic communication and pleading its case to foreign publics. Well, what you have now is a confluence of events where an Israeli government has for a number of years taken American support for granted. Certainly in the during the term of the last administration, and really not focused its strategic efforts to convince the population of a foreign country of its rectitude. And now you have a situation where, you know, they're beginning to wake up to the fact that this ironclad support might not be so ironclad after all, and they may need to work in this field. And they're starting, frankly, from less than zero because they've been neglecting it for so long.
If I could just put a little spin on that. Sure. Yeah, I think that in many ways, and Israeli diplomats have complained to me bitterly about this for more than a decade. There is a view among Israeli diplomats that the Israeli government has sold an image of Israel, which is rooted in the past, which is rooted in Israel surrounded by enemies, which is rooted in to some extent, distrust, if not hatred, of Arabs. And they've been talking to true believers and selling this very, very almost maximalist view of Israel, which some people absorb. What I hear from people is that you have Americans who really aren't interested in maximalist views of any kind. And they go to Israel and or they read about Israel and they say, well, what I'm seeing is not what I've been taught. And so they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater and say, I won't want to have anything to do with Israel or I'm hostile to Israel. When in fact, as I say, the Israeli diplomat view is, look, we're a country that thinks about gay rights, women's rights. It cares about rule of law and the courts and all those kinds of things. And it's a country of diversity, which Americans should instinctively align with, because all the diversity you have in the United States, we have in Israel, and we have a tiny fraction of the number of people you do, and we have more diversity. And so there's this sense that what Israel's been doing is it's been selling a maximalist view of itself and its role in the world to a diminishing circle of true believers, and has been abandoning a large part of the American community, which should have a natural affinity to Israel as a fellow democracy, as a country that believes in pluralism and all those things. And you have Israel continuing to move to the right and an increasing fraction of Israeli Jews saying it's more important that Israel be a Jewish state than it be a democracy. And I think that is a very hard issue for Israelis to think about, with what image of Israel do you want people to have? You've seen all the press about struggles over birthright trips and sort of ideology. I sense that there is an alienation from a sense that Israel is an ideological issue, and people in Israel have been moving ideologically to the right. People in the United States, certainly in younger generations, have been moving ideologically to the left. And whether this is a messaging problem or a problem that the two countries are growing apart, I don't know, but it does feel to me that part of this challenge is the way that Israel has chosen to portray itself is a way that an increasing number of young American Jews say is either not believable or not supportable.
Let me ask you 10 seconds, each of you. Is the two-state, the notion of a two-state solution over very quickly, John, and then Ilan?
It's not over, but it has to be reinvented, because the conventional idea of just going to different sides of a border isn't going to work. It's going to have to be something more complicated. But as unsatisfactory as a two-state solution is, I don't believe there's any other kind of solution. And so the question is, how do you make a two-state solution as viable as it can possibly be?
Yeah, no, I tend to agree. I don't think the two-state solution is over, but it's certainly limping as a strategic concept. And, for American diplomacy to focus on this is, I think, correct. But it also needs to recognize that there are a tremendous amount of impediments to actually moving forward on this objective. Because what you have is you have a deeply divided Palestinian electorate. You don't have somebody who is sort of the unassailed chieftain who can actually speak with authority for Palestinian interests. And what that creates is a dynamic in which the Israelis can argue, as they have argued, that there's nobody to negotiate with, and therefore the two-state solution can't move forward, and all we can do is manage. And breaking out of that mold, I think, is going to be very difficult.
Gentlemen, thanks so much for spending so much time with us. Great conversation. John, thank you. Ilan, thank you. Already looking forward to having both of you guys back on. Thanks again.
Always great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.